session number 10599, reel 19.
Major English, Reel 19. Can you describe to me, Major, the problems of keeping contact and communications with troops fighting in such close quarter positions and situations?
Well, of course, the communications from battalion to companies was, in this situation, radio, 18 sets. There was no question then of any line on telephone. And this, anyway, worked pretty well. And then we had, from company headquarters to platoons, we had the 38 set. And these, again, seemed to work pretty well, although sometimes the radio operator from the platoon might get lost or be knocked out or that sort of thing. But I found that we were keeping touch pretty well. Below that, of course, and indeed throughout, if necessary, it was merely a question of either voice or runners. But we found we could, in this battle anyway, we could keep communications going fairly well.
Being in a house-to-house fighting situation, is there some kind of basic pattern which you attempt to keep your men to in this situation, or is it just fighting as and how it occurs?
Yes. I think this battle wasn't, strictly speaking, a house-to-house operation. The Germans, neither the Germans nor ourselves, were thick enough on the ground, really, for that. But it was a fairly typical French village with roads and lanes running through it. A lot of the houses had back gardens, and there were a number of orchards, and the one or two positions were in houses, probably in the windows, but most of them were in our case, anyway, outside, in the gardens, in the orchards. And I don't think that any of us had to fight our way into houses. So from that angle, it was more typical operation than house-to-house fighting really is, which is a thing on its own, really.
Were there any particular problems which you were concerned with which were so different from the experience that you'd had in the past?
Well, I think the thing that I struck me, really, was the difficulty of seeing where the Germans were. They were very good. I mean, their field craft was excellent. And one occasionally got a glimpse of a movement or a dash across an open space, but usually they were pretty well concealed, and they were after the initial rush, as far as my company was concerned, they were didn't advance further, and it was really a question of trying to drive us out by fire. But later on, the battalion headquarters and A Company were attacked across the orchard with 30 or 40 Germans running at the positions, and they were only thrown back by literally everybody, including all the signalers and runners and batmen and all the officers and everybody, battalion headquarters and A Company, firing, and also a tank that was there firing with its beezers, and they were thrown back when they had got within 20, 30 yards of the position. So it was that was a fairly desperate situation.
Would you go on with the account of the battle, Major?
Yes. Well, the I was saying that I was drawn in a 18 platoon to the 16 platoon area, and then Captain Wheatley, John Wheatley, taken in command of C Company, and he came back down the road with bad news, saying that as far as he could see, C Company had been completely overrun. The company commander, John Laybourne, he'd been wounded, and indeed also Jack Hanna, one of the platoon commanders, and other two platoon commanders, Lieutenants Mould and Galvin, were missing. It was later discovered that Mould had been killed. And now the shelling was getting really tremendous, and it was obvious that the attack was reaching its climax. And machine guns firing and mortars. Anyway, Wheatley was on his way back to battalion headquarters to report the situation. Having done so, he was sent back by the CO, who's second in command, Ted Dunn, to rally his company. And he was coming back down the road, and he gave me a certain amount of news from battalion headquarters, and we were standing, I suppose, about 4 or 5 yards apart, and a mortar bomb landed right between us. And for some reason or another, he got the whole lot. He just collapsed, and I was unhurt. We took him back to the RAP, but I think he was dead by the time he got there.
Was it unusual, Major, for captain in his position with his company commander gone to actually come back with information?
Yes, I think it probably was. He was out of radio contact. Either his set had been put out of action or what, I don't know, but he was out of contact. And I think it would have been, in fact, better if he'd stayed where he was and sent a runner back. And I suspect that Ted Dunn thought the same thing. That's why he was sent back to of his company he could find. Anyway, I'm afraid that was in vain, because, as I say, he was killed. Soon after this, I heard a rifle being fired from the window just near my company headquarters, and we went in, and there was the intelligence officer who'd been what the position was by the CO, the position particularly with C Company. He'd been wounded, but he'd got into this house, and he was using a rifle that he'd got for sniping. the Germans, whenever he saw them, and he was a good shot, and he hit several, but he was wounded in the arm.
Do you recall who that was? Do you recall his name?
Yes. This was now I seem to have forgotten it. If I may, I will carry on, and we shall come to his name presently. I shall remember it. But he was getting fairly badly wounded, losing quite a lot of blood, and so I persuaded him to be evacuated to the RAP. We then heard this heavy battle going on the right, and this was the very strong attack on A Company and the battalion headquarters area, with the which was, as I say, only just stopped really almost at the last minute by the fire of every man and the 24th Lancer tank. We then saw that there were three German tanks coming down the road into our positions. And I got the 17 platoon Piat man. He got down, and just where he could see the leading tank, and he fired his Piat. But the center of the base of the bomb of the Piat, as sometimes happened, came back and hit him in the head and wounded him. It only wounded him, didn't kill him, fortunately. But this was a Piat that it occasionally happened that this part of the base came back at the firer. Anyway, Lansand Wallbanks, who was a platoon sergeant of 17 platoon, he took over the Piat, and he fired three bombs. Two of them landed amongst some cows who were being driven in front of these tanks, but the third one landed under the tank. I don't think, in fact, it did any damage to the tank, but anyway, they decided to pull back after that, and they didn't advance any further. Well, this had been going on from early morning, about 6:30, and by midday, things seemed to be dying down. It got a lot quieter, the shelling stopped, and we were able to reorganize the positions a bit. The CO came round and coordinated the company areas, and he pulled back my company to some houses at the north end of the village of Saint Pierre, and with one platoon on the left in touch with B Company, who were in a ditch and a orchard area just slightly out of the village. And we were digging down, got these positions fairly firm in the afternoon. In the evening, we heard that the quartermaster and the MTO had brought B echelon up and had a hot meal. And so this was this worked well. It was brought down from 103, and we did everybody a lot of good. And then we had a fairly quiet night. There was a lot of houses burning, and two of the 24th Lancers tanks had been knocked out in the counterattack, and they were burning and smouldering in the odd round, shooting off inside the turret of these tanks. But otherwise, we weren't interfered with. And then the next day, the 24th Lancers were relieved by the Sherwood Rangers, which was another armoured regiment in 8th Armoured Brigade. And they moved down, and rather than be on point 103, which in fact was the 8th Armoured Brigade headquarters, the Sherwood Rangers regimental headquarters came down into the village. Not long after they got into this barn and a farmyard area, shells landed right in amongst them. And I think the CO and the adjutant and the intelligence officer and I think two other officers were either killed or wounded before they'd really been able to do anything.
Was this usual again, Major, for them to come so close in the supporting role?
Well, the area is perhaps a little bit bigger than I'm describing it, and they certainly were fairly well forward, but their squadrons, certainly two of their squadrons, were either in or around the village, and they either had to really, they either had to be on 103 or they had to be near the village.
What tanks were they?
Shermans. Yes, the whole. Well, apart from one or two regiments in 7th Armoured Div, I think every tank in 2nd Army was a Sherman by then.
They were an excellent tank, weren't they?
They were a very good tank. Their armour was not tremendous in that they could be knocked out by a German 75. Certainly at 600 or yards or perhaps even more. And there were a tremendous number knocked out. But I think the Germans are reputed to have said that they knock them out and then there's another two there, because the reinforcements in tanks were working extremely well. Soon after that, the Bob Lidwell, the CO, had rejoined, and we met the new brigade commander, and also his intelligence officer, and we got a bit of information. The 7th Armoured Div on our right were coming down with a view to occupying, capturing Tilly-sur-Seul. And we also heard that the assault on the beaches of the other beaches had gone well, with one exception. There was one Omaha beach where the Americans were assaulting. They'd had a very difficult time, but the position had been restored. So we got a bit of wider information, which naturally we passed down. Then in the afternoon, at about 5 o'clock, another heavy artillery and mortar fire came down on us, and we could see on the left quite a large number of German tanks approaching from the east and the southeast, and you could pick them out. There was Tigers, which we'd seen photographs of, and Panthers, which was their new tanks that we hadn't seen in the desert, and the others were Mark IVs, and some worked round to the left and made for point 103, which was obviously the keys of the position really, and that time the CO was up at a conference at 8th Armoured Brigade headquarters, and he couldn't get back to the battalion because of all this shelling, and the battalion in the village, or in the north end of it anyway, were really virtually German tanks behind us. The gun power of these tanks was fairly obvious, and was dreadful really, because there were a lot of Shermans being knocked out. They tried to come in on the village, and they approached B Company positions, which in their line of approach, and the line that the lane in which I think two platoons of B Company were enfiladed really by these tanks, and that caused a lot of casualties, and the situation was very tricky there for a time. The CO of the officer commanding B Company, which is regular Tommy Clapton, he was badly wounded, and as indeed was the second in command, Ted Dunn, and they were both in fact killed by, they died of their wounds, and we could hear, I could hear on my radio the signal officer talking to B Company and giving them the situation. And I saw at the far end of an orchard on our left that there was an anti-tank gun there, but without a crew for some reason. Anyway, my batman and I crawled forward to this gun. And because we, from there, we had a very good view, about 200 or 300 yards away, with German tanks with their flanks ready to us. And we thought, well, we must get some fire on these tanks. Anyway, we tried to work this gun. Neither of us had ever fired a 6-pounder anti-tank gun. And we mucked about with this for a bit, and then we realized that the crew had taken the firing mechanism away from the thing. But so we crawled back again, and I sent Corley to get this gun crew, and we routed them out, and we got three. And he crawled back with them, showed them where took them to the gun, and they loaded it. And they found, actually, when they were down, actually behind the gun, that in fact they couldn't, there was just a little bit of high ground, they couldn't actually see. So Corley stood up and then directed the fire. And I think they certainly did some damage to some tanks, but if they didn't, they never came any nearer. So Corley did well that day. He got a military medal for that particular piece of fighting. We then found also that the tanks were coming down the street again, as they had yesterday. And by that time, following the incident with the Piat, I got one of our anti-tank guns there, manned by Sergeant Leggett, and he was in position ready to shoot. It was obviously going to be a frontal position, but there was nothing else for it. And they came down, and very cautiously, and if one looked right out to the right, stretching sort of towards the hedge, you could just see the track of the leading tank. And I think we agreed not to fire yet till they came to a better target. But in fact, they never did. They never came any nearer. And I think we would have been in a good position to have stopped them. Then the evening came on, and dark began to fall, and the German tanks pulled back. And things became a lot quieter, and I think we could then appreciate that at least we'd held another attack there. B Company had lost quite a number of their men, and the CO brought A Company over to their area, and he moved my company over to the right into A Company's old positions. But we had a bit of shelling in the night, but there was no attacks. Everyone was very alert, of course. This was one of the problems with infantry, and I dare say other people as well, that after an action like that, everyone tends to be very alert. And what they ought to have been doing, of course, the sentries ought to be alert, and the rest should be trying to get some rest or sleep. And this, I think, was a matter of discipline, really. One had to instill that everybody can't be awake all the time, because eventually the whole thing will collapse with fatigue. And this is a thing we had to relearn as the days went on. Dawn came, and there wasn't any German attack, which we'd expected. We sent patrols forward, and 18 Platoon Commander Ernie Cousins went forward towards the bridge over the River Searle, and found that the Germans had pulled back, and we established a post there, which Lieutenant Jelland of B Company. He took over from there, and we also actually captured six Germans, and definitely identified the Panzer Lehr Division from their uniforms.
What state were they in, Major?
They were perhaps a similar state to us, really, tired and rather dirty, and but their morale seemed all right. And they weren't by any means at the end of their tether. And we also learned quite definitely that taking part in the second attack on us was the 12th SS Panzer Division. In the afternoon, this of course by now was the 11th of June, we were told that the 8th Armoured Brigade, including 8 DLI, had to withdraw from Saint-Pierre. Well, first reaction, of course, is one relief, really, to be out of the fighting for a little bit. But we also thought it was a great pity, as we'd occupied the village and held it against two attacks and suffered quite a lot of casualties as a result. But we were still there, and it seemed a shame, really, to give it up after all that. But the reason given was it was quite obvious that we could not attack and capture the Texel-Bretteville feature, which had been the original objective, and a completely fresh division was needed for that. And 7th Armoured Brigade on our right, in the meantime, had been driven out of Tilly, the first of many occasions when it changed hands from one side to the other. And as because of that, our position in Saint-Pierre was rather exposed. And they thought that we should come back. And just to rub in the disappointment of it, later on, about 3 weeks later, I think, 10th DLI of the 49th Division, 10th was the duplicate battalion originally of the 6th Battalion, they attacked Saint-Pierre again and only captured it after a pretty stiff fight lasting most of the day. Anyway, that was the situation, and that I suppose is war. So, in the middle of the night nearly, at about 11:15, we moved back, marching back up to point 103 and down the other side. 103 was now held by the 5th East Yorks of 69th Brigade, and we met up with troop-carrying lorries who took us back to the village of Cashy, which is 3 miles south of Bayeux. And there we had a hot meal, and everyone settled down to a jolly good sleep. So this really was the blooding, if that's the right word, of quite a number of people in the battalion. And I think we realised that at least we were a match for the Germans. But we'd had a lot of casualties. We had 12 officer casualties and 190 other ranks.
Do you recall any officer of the rank who particularly distinguished themselves that day?
Well, I mentioned Lance Arne Richmond, who was then commanding 17 Platoon. He did an extremely good job. He was put up for and gained a military medal. The intelligence officer, whose name was Peter Laws, we had a Peter Lorne, but his name was Peter Laws, he got an MC for his action at Saint-Pierre. And there was certainly a military medal gained by a corporal in A Company, whose name I haven't got at the moment, I'm afraid.
So within a fighting situation, and this is really a general question, Major, did you come across in your experience men who liked the art of killing Germans? I'm thinking particularly of the more ruthless personality. Did you ever come across any who were like that?
Yes. I don't recollect anyone who took a delight in it. There were several who were very efficient at it. I wouldn't like to sit here now and say that they liked it. Several people realized that if they were going to survive, they had to be good at killing the enemy, and this they did. And of course, the leaders came through in situations like this, and they needn't necessarily been officers. They needn't necessarily been NCOs. There were one or two privates who came through, who of course became NCOs, who showed leadership ability.